Take two.
Testing. Is this thing on?
Boy. If you saw earlier in this week on Facebook, I did put up a thing saying that we were having a few technical issues and we actually recorded the entire podcast and found out that that recording was pretty much unusable due to the microphone not setting up correctly in our previous attempt. Woo!
What fun and games.
Anyway, welcome back to What the History of Photography.
Hi, everyone.
Yeah, we're back. We're going to hear, going to have some fun, talk about some silly history.
Yeah, I'm in. And those in Brisbane, I'm really sorry about the eclipse. Well, it's spinning down outside here because we are in Brisbane, as most people know. I want to see the eclipse. God damn it.
Yeah, not looking good eclipse-wise. So let's talk history instead.
Yep. All righty. Okay, well, thank you, everyone who's joined us.
Remember, pause the intro.
Okay. Oh, I don't have to pause it right now for the intro, do I?
Well, I thought we were just going to start the intro. Or do you want to thank them now?
I want to thank everyone. I'd like to thank the Academy. And I would love to thank all our new likers out there. Thank you so much for liking our page and being interested.
Woo!
Yeah, thank you. Welcome.
You guys rock.
You do. And don't ever forget it.
That's right. Now, because this is the second time of recording this and we're in a closed room on a stuffy night, we're going to get on with this.
All right, let's do it.
What the... Hello and welcome back to What the History for 2018. I am Trevor Holland.
And I'm Susie Holland.
And we are here with a couple of bizarre bits of history to make you say, what the history?
Because they usually make us say, what the history, so.
Absolutely. So to see us off in the new year, Susie, what do you have for us?
All right. I'm going to take you all the way back. Are you comfortable? Are you ready to go all the way back? Okay. Ooh. I'm going to take you all the way back to the heady days of 2017. I love that. This particular What The focuses on how far one guy named Uber Butler took rating scores for a restaurant that he had on TripAdvisor. If you don't know what TripAdvisor is, it's an online tool which people advise others on certain places they've been and they write a review, be it a good review or not so good review. I myself wrote one in 2016 when I was in New Zealand about a place that wasn't so good in my humble opinion, and I'm not going to say any more about that. Anyway, back to Uber's restaurant. On TripAdvisor, he was getting really good reviews from foodies that have been there and had gorgeous pics of the food and people having a great time. Except it was all fake. Let me explain about how a guy from Dulwich, London, got his fake restaurant, which he named The Shed at Dulwich, to number one on TripAdvisor. One of Uber's previous jobs was to write fake reviews for restaurants, which he'd never been to, for £10, which would be submitted to TripAdvisor to lure more people to these restaurants, creating money based on his words. It got Uber thinking that TripAdvisor was, and I quote, a false reality, end quote. The restaurants were real. The experiences were fake. There was no way one could fake a restaurant, could they? Could they? One day, Uber was sitting in his shed at Dulwich when a thought struck him that a fake restaurant may indeed be a possibility, and again I quote, and then, one day, sitting in the shed I live in, I had a revelation. Within the current climate of misinformation and society's willingness to believe absolute bullshit, maybe a fake restaurant is possible. Maybe it's exactly the kind of place that could be a hit. In that moment, it became my mission. With the help of fake reviews, mystique, and nonsense, I was going to do it. Turn my shed into London's top-rated restaurant on TripAdvisor. End quote. So in April 2017, Uber began his grand plan and got himself a phone so he could be 1. Verified with TripAdvisor and 2. Take calls from people once they saw how wonderful the shed at Dulwich was on TripAdvisor. They would flock to his shed. So 1 £10 burner phone later and Uber was in business. He listed the street of the shed and that it was an appointment-only restaurant to stop people from just rocking up. He built a website and bought a domain name and came up with a quirky idea for the menu. All the meals were moods, named Lust, Empathetic, Contemplation, Happy, Comfort and Love. The quirky idea caught on with foodies of London and abroad, and it says in the menu, and again I quote, "We don't have a traditional menu per se. Instead of meals, our menu is comprised of moods. You choose what fits your day and our chef interprets that. We can also tailor dishes for special occasions and for extra cost," end quote. And the pics of the food on the website looked delicious, but in keeping with the fake shed, these were fake too. The chocolate sundae was a sponge dipped in brown paint and shaving cream on the side, and an egg which may have been bacon and parsley was an egg with parsley resting on Uber's foot, which just goes to show that looks can be deceiving. Lo and behold, the shed at Dulwich gets accepted onto TripAdvisor, and then Uber puts his friends and acquaintances into action, writing their reviews to TripAdvisor to allow the shed to garner more ratings, and soon the shed has hit the top 10,000 of London's restaurants based solely on these reviews, and then the shed's phone starts ringing off the hook, with people trying to get a table, and every time Uber tells them the shed is fully booked. People start booking months in advance, and Uber realizes, like a lot of people would, the reason for these bookings is people are so struck by the unknown, wanting something they don't know a lot about, or they can't have, in this case a table or an address. By the end of August, the shed is at 156 out of 18,167 restaurants in London. Yay! Companies begin sending free product samples to the approximate area of the shed using Google Maps, yay for technology, and an Australian promotions company gets in contact to show the shed globally for in-flight videos for an aircraft company. A council emails Uber to see if he wants to move the shed to a bit of land they are developing at Bromley, approximately 30 minutes away, and of course soon there are people wanting to come and work at the shed. Uber was then contacted by a, quote, results hungry, end quote, PR company who wants to get the shed onto Mail Online with a Batman-themed launch, but Uber decides to handle his own publicity for obvious reasons. People start coming up to Uber in his street asking where the shed is, and he starts getting emails from people around the world asking for a table at his fictitious restaurant. Then on November 1st, he receives an email from TripAdvisor with the heading Information Request. Uber thinks that this experiment is all over, but instead, with 89,000 requests for information on the shed in one day, let's let that sink in for a bit, on TripAdvisor, has led the shed at Dulwich, a fake restaurant, to hit the number one spot in all London. It took 6 months. On the written account from Uber, which has become my primary source material, he writes, and again I quote, "On TripAdvisor's website, the company said it dedicates significant time and resources to ensuring that the content on TripAdvisor reflects the real experiences of real travellers," end quote. So Uber reaches out to TripAdvisor, asking them how he was able to fool them, and the response was, and again I quote, "Generally, the only people who create fake restaurants listings are journalists in misguided attempts to test us," replies a representative via email. As there is no incentive for anyone in the real world to create a fake restaurant, it is not a problem we experience with our regular community. Therefore, this test is not a real-world example. Most fraudsters are only interested in trying to manipulate the rankings of real businesses. So the distinction between attempted fraud by a real business as opposed to attempted fraud for a non-existent business is important. To catch these people out, TripAdvisor uses state-of-the-art technology to identify suspicious review patterns and says, "Our community too can report suspicious activity to us." They then quote a 2015 study that found 93% of TripAdvisor users said they found the reviews they read to be accurate of the actual experience. End quote. So, experiment over. Unsurprisingly, the phone doesn't stop ringing for people to book a table, so Uber decides to give the public what they want and makes the shed at Dulwich a reality, but hits another snag. How is he going to recreate the mood meals? And in 4 days? Because he decided to do the launch 4 days after everything happened with TripAdvisor and the 89,000 requests that he received. Now, he decides to enlist friends to be the chef, DJ and waitress, and meets the guests outside in the street with blindfolds so they don't see the state of his yard, which he has cleaned up, and even cleans out a children's cubby house and has a few chickens in it. Much like lobsters, where people can choose their lobster to eat, people can choose a chicken. Uber decides that with a little money, but with a lot of style, he can get his chef to make microwave food and oven-baked lasagna and mac and cheese and cup of soups in mugs of minestrone and mugs of pudding. And it was a hit. The DJ created sounds of the restaurant to create ambience and disguise the sound of the ding of the microwave. Oh, I love it. People were ready to rebook the shed. Uber decided not to charge anyone, telling them it was for a TV show, and just goes to show the power of the internet and the modern age. A search of TripAdvisor has no trace of the shed at Dulwich. Aww. And as a last quote, Uber has written, quote, "If I can transform my garden into London's best restaurant, literally anything is possible," end quote. Uber, my hat goes off to you, sir.
Yeah, that's
I am impressed, really impressed at your ingenuity. And maybe when I go over to the UK in September, late August, early September, I might even have to visit old Dulwich. I might check out Uber.
I should see if he's still got that phone.
I'm going to see if he's there. I'd like a table. Oh, bless. I really love this story. So thank you so much, Rochelle and Rachel, for sharing this story with me and with all our friends. Yeah, I couldn't go past it. I loved it. It was a great story. And, yeah, like I said, Uber, your ingenuity really makes me happy. I love it.
Indeed. So you might have to get his digits.
Yes, I might have to call him on the phone.
Yeah, get his phone digits. This is a really ham-fisted segue, but it is relevant. So anyway, on to something else.
Bing, bing.
There is a saying that states, you can't stop progress. It's also incredibly easy to find examples where people have rejected this old adage and have fought against change any way they could. Such was the case back in mid-1962. Concerned by the rapid increase of phone usage in the United States, the Pacific Telephone and Telegraph Company, commonly referred to as Ma Bell, started changing how phone calls were made. Up until this time, calls were placed by contacting an operator and asking to be put through to a particular number attached to an exchange. For example, you would ask to be connected to such numbers as Murray Hill 59975 or Clearwater 67841, please. 1962 saw the commencement of changing to an all-digit dialing system, allowing more phone numbers to be generated to allow for future growth and also assist with the automation of connecting phone calls. This may seem standard now, but at the time, there was a very robust opposition to the change. Enter the Anti-Digit Dialing League, or ADDL for short.
That's brilliant.
In the ADDL's own pamphlet against Ma Bell's violation of the natural order, titled Phones Are for People, they described the founding of the group as starting, quote, over a cup of coffee, where the conversation turned to how, again a quote, they found the new system extremely confusing and difficult to use, end quote. This conversation ended with a notice being published in the classified section of a San Francisco newspaper, and within 10 days, over 3,500 people had responded. And as the movement spread, there was correspondence from all over the US as people volunteered to start chapters in their own areas. One of the founding members and co-author of Phones Are for People and semanticist Samuel Hayakawa, who later became a US senator, told Time magazine in July of 1962, quote, "These people are systematically trying to destroy the use of memory. They tell you to write it down, not memorize it. Try writing a telephone number down in a dark booth while groping for a pencil, searching in an obsolete phone book and gasping for breath.
I love this.
And all this in the name of efficiency. Engineers have a terrible intellectual weakness. If it fits the machine, they say, then it ought to fit the people. This is something that bothers me very much. Absent-mindedness about people." End quote. And I'm sure he didn't have an English accent, but
well,
that's just what happened.
I love the way you did that. That was great.
So, how were people fighting this digitized attack on the memory of the phone-using public? Some took it to a bit of an extreme. An article in the Ogden Standard Examiner described a housewife picking up the phone, connecting to the operator and saying, quote, "Would you please get me number 3,176,429,682, end quote. There are also claims of phone bills being overpaid by a couple of pennies in order to cause problems with Marbell's bookkeeping, and even people poking extra holes into punch cards used by operators. Another one of the ADDL's founders, Carl May, did not really approve of such tactics, calling them juvenile and saying in the same article, quote, "There are legal channels to voice our protests and we plan to use them. We are getting a hearing before the State Public Utilities Commission and we will tell them that the company is not being realistic in expecting people to react like machines." Hmm. End quote. This protest was maintained for some time. In an article in the Village Voice in February of 1963, John Wilcock lamented how the phone company would, quote, "neither listen to reason or discuss the situation," end quote. Despite the ADDL attempting to launch a court case against the changeover to digit dialing. So what was his proposed solution? Quote, "What I suggest is that all of you, anywhere in the US, who object to this arrogant attitude of the phone company, pick up the telephone at any and every opportunity, dial zero, and say to the operator, 'I'm calling to register my vote against digit dialing.'" End quote. He went on to suggest that if enough calls were made, then the phone company might be more willing to discuss the matter with the ADDL's lawyers. By 1964, it seemed that the furor had died down and the change was made. But don't think this sort of thing can only happen in the 60s.
Oh no.
No, in May of 2001, when a shortage of telephone numbers appeared to be looming, additional area codes were being added, turning the common 9-digit phone numbers of the time into 10 to 11 digit monstrosities. In a New York Times article, one Miguel Segovia, a graduate student at Harvard Divinity School, stated, quote, "It is incredibly disorienting. I now get the annoying feeling that my life is becoming cluttered with numbers," end quote. And Lemuel Gordon, an 81-year-old farmer, said, quote, "I recognize the telephone is a convenience, but all these new numbers are such a damn nuisance. It's enough to make you feel like a victim of the numbers age."
Oh dear.
End quote. So it just goes to show that even 40 years apart, what the history can repeat.
And yes, my goodness. And something that Trev and I were being quite profound about the last time we did this, what the history, like about maybe half an hour ago.
Yeah.
And then a giant roar from the studio came that Trev had worked out that the previous podcast was unusable.
Yay!
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I'm sure he woke up China with that roar.
We've been having lots of issues.
Oh, yeah. Just issues. Yeah, that now when you speak into your phone and ask them to call
a restaurant.
A restaurant.
Or a person in your phone book.
Yeah, and that you don't have to dial.
Yeah.
So, yeah, your phone has become the operator.
That's great. And you don't even need to say, call Brisbane 59372 or any rubbish like that. It's, you know, hey, Google, phone this restaurant for me, and it does it.
Yeah, so that is, you know, we found that quite profound that, you know.
It's like a full circle thing.
Yep.
That's right.
Everything old is new again.
And what history is repeating Again.
As the great Shirley Bassey and the Propeller Head said, history repeating.
You, the hero.
Love that woman.
Excerpt of that in our opening theme.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
And so, there we go. That's our second attempt for our 2018 return episode for all you wonderful What the Historians out there.
We couldn't give you a substandard sort of podcast. We had to give you a good one to start with.
That's right. And considering
that's not to that say that we won't keep giving you good ones throughout the year.
Oh, we've got some absolutely awesome stuff coming up. Over the break, we have been adding plenty of topics to our list.
And having a massive giggle.
Oh, there are some doozies. Geez. Yeah. Yep.
We love history and we love the whole strange things that have happened throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, there are millions.
And I hope that you're loving What the History too. Now, if you are, I'm only going to ask this just the once. If you like What the History, please head on to Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. And why not leave us a review and a nice high, preferably 5-star rating if you'd like, to help us get us out there. And
yeah, get us number one on TripAdvisor.
Don't think TripAdvisor works for podcasts.
Why not?
And please share the podcast with anybody and everybody you know. Because the more people we get on board, the more What the Historians there are, and the more fun we can all have together.
That's right.
And
come and join us. We promise we won't bite.
And if you would like to get in touch with us, I don't think you can ask Google to call What the History. That probably won't work. But what you can do is find the What the History podcast page on Facebook. You can find pod_what on Twitter or find the hashtag WTHpod. Or you can send us an email to WTHpod@rufusproject.com. Or if you like going to YouTube and you check out the enhanced version of this podcast, which may or may not be available at the same time this podcast goes out, I'll see how I go. You can also leave us comments there. Now, all the links to our contact details and all the references are down in the description below, unless you're watching the enhanced podcast, in which case there will be a link to the page with all the links and reference material. Whew, this is getting complicated.
Yeah.
But it's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we love it. And also, guys, in North Brisbane, it's peeing down with rain now. So no eclipse for us. And I'm sad.
The one night we
one night,
don't want it to rain.
It's been threatening for the last 2 weeks to rain. So choose us tonight, the night of a blood moon, full moon, and an eclipse. Thank you, weather gods.
I look forward to watching a replay online later.
I'm so hoping to get out there and doing the whole thing and get my telescope out.
Yeah.
Thanks, D.
We would have used it.
We would have used the new telescope, hon.
Anyway, I think on that note, because this is the second recording of this and I need to do things like editing, I hope you enjoyed that. And please come back in a couple of weeks where we have two more bits of bizarre history to make you say,
what the history? Good night and stay dry.
Catch you later.
Or go and dance in the rain.